number 13, and hatchery policy C3619. This is a review, a briefing, and public comment. Mr. Warren.
Chair Carpenter, members of the commission, good morning. I'm Ron Warren, the director of fish policy for the agency. I have with me Dr. Ken Warhite, who's the director of molecular genetics and our fish health staff. And we are here to talk about the new draft that we're calling CEPA review draft and highlight some different aspects of that new draft for you today. I can make things work. So we'll start off with a little bit of the commission guidance that got us to this point. We'll review the CEPA review draft. We've got a new section within the CEPA review draft that Ken will spend a fair amount of time on. And then we'll talk about the proposed schedule that we have depending on commission action today for that. For this document. So back in December, the commission took or talked through and gave guidance to the writing working group to look at multiple aspects of the November 6th document that we'd taken considerable public comment on, as well as met with our co-managers on, and certainly taken a lot of comment from both. They include the first one, just to review the document for its readability, and we've done that. We've made improvements, and we've also removed Appendix 3 from the document. We've also, Dr. Warhite will talk about the detailed scientific, analytical, and concept that's addressed in the second bullet there. And I will highlight some additional modifications sentences that are now included in the revised policy language that respond directly to tribal co-manager requests and concerns. The final bullet there, there is some new language in this area, particularly with respect of the initiative for additional hatchery production for southern resident orca prey enhancement. And I'll cover that as we get to it. I'm hoping this works. The draft, the title of the draft policy is the anadromous salmon and steelhead hatchery policy. And if I have any luck with this, I'll just go to our website and show commissioners what that looks like. I'm not sure if I have to reshare that screen. Can you see that, Nikki?
Yeah, it looks good. Make okay. It.
Yep. Yep, let me get that to there and give it a little bit of size. How's that look for folks? Thanks, Commissioner or Chair Carpenter. Appreciate the head nod there. So I'm just going to quickly go through this to allow some time to the the part of the policy that is most changed and give more time to that. But I wanted to say that as a CEPA review draft, I'll highlight those changes and then let Ken talk about it. You can, as I scroll down, there's virtually no changes or very little changes to the purpose section. The authority and definition and intent, the Or the general policy statement. So the piece that we get to that has the most significant change as we come down through here is in this final paragraph of the of this section, where I'm just trying to get to the point where I can highlight it for you, where we talk about language that we heard from co-managers and tried to address concerns that we heard and requests that were made about this policy serves as the state's interim guidance until a joint policy agreement is developed with Puget Sound, Coastal, or Columbia River tribal co-managers when complete and completed and approved by tribal co-managers and the commission. The new tribal co-manager joint policy agreement shall supersede the provisions of this policy in the geographic area applicable to the practical agreement. Sorry about that. So then we go down through the following sections. The sections 1, 2, and 3, minor grammatical modifications. Section 4, I'm going to blaze right by because Ken's going to talk about that after I'm done. The policy guidance number 5, the production increases may occur. That product, so the modification is that the production, or highlights that the production increases may occur, that production reductions in hatcheries may occur within this new policy. In number 6, this new paragraph emphasizes the original intent to do something meaningful to help our southern resident orca prey concerns. And then number 7 through 10 essentially don't have any modifications. In number 9, we do call for some requests for funding to improve our ability to implement this policy. And then we get to the adaptive management sections. And within the adaptive management section, two of the prior paragraphs are eliminated with the necessary essence moved into the risk assessment that you'll hear from Dr. Warheit on, and structured decision-making concept described in that policy guidance number 4. The last paragraph on aligning changes with ESA coverage and existing salmon recovery plans have been streamlined, but without essential changes to the policy.
Ron, if I may, Commissioner Thorburn has a question or a comment.
Thank you. Sorry, I didn't notice this the other day at the Fish Committee meeting, but back on the statement about the interim guidance until we have a joint policy with the, it says Puget Sound, Coastal, or Columbia River tribes. Shouldn't it be and?
Sorry, Chair Carpenter, Commissioner Thorburn, I'm trying to go back up and find out where I was when I highlighted that. So
it had the had the highlight.
Yeah, I had, I had highlighted those. So I think Commissioner Thorburn, what the writing group was trying to accomplish is that. As we have conversations with a variety of tribal governments relative to what might be those joint co-manager policies for hatcheries, we may not achieve agreement or achieve agreement, and they may be a little bit different. We were trying to give ourselves options about the timing of the implementation of each of those geographic areas with those tribes, or the overall concept if it were to stay within all of USV Washington area and USV Oregon area. So just trying to leave ourselves some latitude depending on how that process progresses forward.
Thank you, Ron. That's a great clarification.
Ron, I see that we have two commissioners, Commissioner McIsaac and then Vice Chair Baker, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ron, if you could just stay with that same paragraph that we were looking at with regard to the last section of the general policy. And this was not discussed at the Fish Committee meeting by omission, but if you highlight the last sentence in the paragraph above that, this state policy is not considered a tribal co-manager agreed joint policy. That sentence, I believe, is also a new sentence that was not in the November draft that is there. This is the last sentence in the paragraph above this paragraph. Yeah, there we go. That this is a new sentence from the November draft, and it also comes at the direct request of some Puget Sound tribal policy folk. And that didn't get discussed at the Fish Committee, but at any rate, can you verify that that is an additional new sentence that that moves us a little bit further down the line in tribal co-management according to their desires?
Yes, sir. Thank you for pointing that out.
Thank you, Commissioner McCutcheon. Vice Chair Baker, please.
Thank you. Saving all the kudos for later. Ron, my question is also about the paragraph that you have highlight or that you have up here. If this, I just want to make sure that I understand that if this policy is going to be the interim policy while the technical documents that Ken's going to talk about gets developed, are we going to get briefed on a staging process? For instance, my real question is, we're not going to run out and start a bunch of HMPs before the technical document is developed, are we?
Chair Carpenter, Vice Chair Baker, we have that information coming up later as Ken works through this risk management framework for the commission's the commission presentation. So we'll get to that. But
okay,
to answer
thank
your
you.
Question,
sorry.
No, we are not.
Okay.
Thank you, Ron. Continue on.
So with that, now comes Dr. Warheit's presentation on the risk management framework. And we haven't practiced this portion of it, but Ken, just holler when you want me to change slides.
Thank you. Thank you, Ron. I'm going to focus entirely or nearly entirely on this objective four, which is a significant change from the previous version of that objective. This change is generally in response to the commission receiving comments both from the public, from the tribes, and from WDFW staff, finding that that there needed to be more clarity and more direction in terms of many things, but basically two major subjects. One is that we needed to detail a bit more on how this balance between benefits of the hatcheries and the risks of the hatcheries would be achieved. And secondly, to point to and focus where the science is going to take place. To me, that's always an odd sentence because to me, science takes place everywhere and always. But we do want to focus on the fact that there are explicit areas on which both biological and potentially social science will occur. As Ron had mentioned previously, we are proposing a kind of structured decision-making process. This plot is an example of what this would look like. This may not be what is in this future document, and we are going to be designing this technical procedures document. It may be or maybe not, but I do want to go through the general themes of this process that are highlighted by this, this flow chart, and emphasize the areas that we're going to, that this technical procedures document would occur. So Ron, if you can advance it and then advance it one more time so I get a highlight there. So advance it once and then that's good. Thank you. So basically this decision analytic process or structured decision-making process always starts with a problem or a decision that has to occur. And in this particular case, the example I'm going to use here is basically production levels from a hatchery. Hatcheries are tasked to produce fish, but how many fish should they produce? And oftentimes the amount of fish being produced ranging from zero, essentially all the way up to 10 million or so, is in essence what is controversial. So this sort of the structured process is going to start off with that general concept that we have to make a decision about production. And then we have objectives. Why are we producing fish? And in producing fish, what are our objectives in for that production? One is that we want to maximize benefits of production. And another way of saying that as an objective can be is that we would like to have harvest satisfaction, both commercial and recreational, and we want to ensure that tribal fishing rights are achieved. So all of these together go into sort of this benefit package of satisfaction overall. A second objective is that we want to minimize environmental risk from that production. Another way of thinking that is that we want to make sure that wild salmon and steelhead populations have health, that they are healthy populations and they are functioning within the ecosystem. So we start with that concept, and now we have to understand what basically the alternatives are here. So if you move to the second, Ron, click it again, please. So this whole process is going to start where we're going to explicitly define what hatchery goals are. Currently, we do that. That's part of the current policy. But this continues on here. Each hatchery is going to have explicit goals, and those explicit goals can be adaptively managed. The second thing is that we have to have knowledge about what the affected wild populations are, their status. That could either be federal state listings. It could also be just the overall status, whether they're current, whether they exist, whether they are sustainable, whether they are self-sustainable, whether they have a growing or declining population. So all those are the starting points for this. And then we're going to propose, there could be a proposal of some hatchery production. You move to the next slide. So this is the middle section of this flowchart. Remember, this flowchart is an example, but these are the concepts. We need to have a problem, a decision. We need objectives. We need starting with hatchery goals and some knowledge about the affected wild populations. Now, this can be considered where the science occurs. Well, like I said, science occurs to me everywhere, but this is explicitly where we're going to talk about some biological science and potentially some social science. We focus on the left side of this. This section right here, this middle section overall, you can think of as a risk assessment. Part of this is we have to identify what the hazards are. And hazards are those things that may negatively affect a wild population. They have to be explicitly identified. Some of these hazards have already been explicitly identified through the work of many people that have examined the benefits and risks of hatcheries, but explicitly the Hatchery Science Review Group, the HSRG, has worked a lot on this. These hazards can be genetic hazards, for example, hatchery populations with potentially lower fitness interbreeding with wild populations. These hazards can be ecological, competition, predation, those sorts of things. We're going to try to take a very explicit way of looking at this thing. We want to be able to determine what is the probability of those hazards occurring, and if they do occur, what their impact would be. We're going to do this as objectively and as analytically as possible, but together these constitute risk. On the other side, there are benefits. The assets from hatchery production are, I mean, to me, we wouldn't be producing hatchery fish unless we consider that it's an asset to the tribes, it's an asset to society, it's assets to the economy of the state. So we think about explicit things like that, like simply production for recreational harvest, production for commercial harvest, production for tribal harvest, all of those things. We assess the probability and impact of those things. But there's also some conservation benefits that the Southern Resident Orca Initiative, that's an explicit part of the policy, is also another asset. It can lead to a benefit, conservation of Southern Resident Orcas, but we will also assess the probability and impact of that. This middle section is basically, in essence, what we are doing now. And if you can think about the science that we do right now has to do with calculating things like PHAS or PNOB or PNI. These are basically metrics to determine what are the effects, how many hatchery fish are spawning on the spawning grounds, and how much hatchery wild fish are basically going into the broodstock. All these things are still part of this process right now. The next part, advance, Ron, please. So this is an area where the decision is made. Are we going to increase hatchery production? Are we going to keep hatchery production the same? Or are we going to decrease hatchery production? You'll notice that I've highlighted this as the risk management sort of ellipse right there. The structured decision-making people refer to this part of this thing as what's called a multi-objective trade-off under uncertainty. We're not calling it that, we're calling it risk management. But basically what this is that a decision maker has to take information from a variety of areas. The science, that's above. The decision maker is also taking information from existing requirements. These are treaty requirements or legal obligations that we have in terms of production. The decision maker is also going to be taking information, that social information, economic information, policy information. The things that are in this policy itself, the decision maker has to consider, and political, all the things that go into making decisions. Again, there are trade-offs that have to be made during this process, and this is where the trade-offs will be identified. It's all based on a value system. Ultimately, a decision would be made in terms of what hatchery production is. Advance it once, Ron. But I do want to point out here, this is highlighting the section called broodstock management. That is not necessarily the only thing. There are things that can be done in making decisions that may mitigate some of these risks. Broodstock management, that's been an emphasis of the HSRG is an example of a mitigating factor. We can potentially decrease the risks through proper broodstock management. This is the mixing of hatchery and wild fish in both in wild and in the hatchery itself. And there are other things, there are hatchery practices that may decrease some of the potential hazards. You know, when fish are released, changing issues in terms of potential competition. These are things that can also be implemented to reduce risk. One more, Ron. Thank you. Then lastly, none of this happens with any bit of efficacy unless we can monitor it. This is the monitoring and evaluation part. We have key things that we have to identify that we monitor and evaluate. And all that information needs to go back and feed back into the system. It feeds back into the science. It feeds back into what our hatchery goals are. And it feeds back into the status of the wild population. It may even also feed back in terms of basically what our objectives are. This is a continual loop. We do this on a continual basis. And the operations of our hatcheries will be based on something like this. Next slide. So, Vice Chair Baker had asked a question about basically what is the steps in the process here. Assuming that this policy gets approved, goes through SEPA, then gets approved, there are things that are going to happen immediately. The first thing that happens immediately is that we're going to start working on this technical procedures document. This thing that I just went through, the flowchart, the risk management framework. to do that, we're going to initially start off with an outreach to tribal co-managers. We would hope that they would be able to develop this technical procedures document with us. So that would be the first thing. Obviously, we need to assemble a development team. I also want to emphasize that it'll take us about a year to produce this document. During this entire time, we're going to be basically making periodic progress reports to the commission. And I assume that there will be, at that point, potentially public comment on it. We'll have a draft final report. There'll be public comment on the draft final report or the draft final document, essentially. This document itself. So the current policy needs to go through SEPA. This other document, the technical procedures document, must go through SEPA, two SEPAs. So we'll have SEPA review on that, and then hopefully eventually a final, I keep saying report here, but basically a final document will be produced. The other two things I want to highlight below number two there, things with the stars, these two other things are also going to occur the moment that this current policy, the one we're evaluating right now, passes. One is that all existing, and this is language that's taken directly out of the policy itself, existing hatchery operations, plans, goals, and objectives that are in effect on June 14th, basically the day before the 2018 commission meeting, when this whole process began, the day before that, everything rolls back to that point in time. So existing hatchery operations, plans, goals, objectives that were in effect prior to that meeting remain intact as current policy direction. So effectively, this policy is moving the existing policy forward based on that, that statement. So there's no gap in what we are doing. This is basically existing policy. We're working on this policy. That's the emphasis. The other thing too is that we are going to start development of a joint policy agreement on salmon and steelhead hatchery programs with tribal co-managers. We've made that commitment to the tribal co-managers, and hopefully the development of the technical procedures document will go hand in hand with that. So these are things that are going to happen right away after the implementation of this policy.
Dr. Warhite, may I interrupt? Commissioner Smith has her hand up with a question or comment.
You're muted.
Thank you, Dr. Warhite. I'm learning all this with a steep learning curve, I realize. So I have a question that's kind of a basic question. I'm assuming that on systems where wild fish runs are extirpated, and I'm assuming we have hatcheries on some systems like that, then, you know, the wild fish competition, if you will, is not a factor. I don't know about ocean competition, you know, when they're all out there together, but let's leave that issue aside for a moment. Because my real question is there agreement among the scientific community, among the tribes, on which systems have, you know, the wild fish runs are truly extirpated, and if there's, you know, if there's a natural, you know, breeding going on in those systems, it's the hatchery fish that are doing it. Is that a clear question?
Yeah, it is a clear question. I wouldn't say that there's an agreement. There are documents that have been produced by National Marine Fisheries Services, where they specifically, I know two of them for steelhead and Chinook, where they've gone through, populations in salmon, the Chinook and steelhead populations in Puget Sound, for example. And they've gone through which populations have been determined to be extirpated. So there are some documentation like that. But basically, so if you can look at those as for at least those two species, that would highlight that. There are also many populations where there is potentially natural spawning occurring, but the production out of the natural spawning may be extremely low. And that basically the natural spawning is just simply renewed by hatchery fish coming on. Why that came about isn't necessarily agreed about. It could be due to the hatchery fish. It could be due to the habitat quality. But all that information is going to get fed into that flow diagram. So I'm not going to predetermine what kind of management activities would occur in any particular system. That information would be part of the process. So did that answer your question? Okay, thank you.
Dr. Warheit, Commissioner Kuntz has his hand up as well.
You're muted as well.
Boy, old people. I think it's a related question. I think you just answered it. So my question is, back on that, you don't have to go back on the slide, but on the decision-making slide, when you talk about wild population, does that mean both native origin and natural born origin?
You're going to have to provide a little bit more clarity in terms of the difference between those native and natural.
I mean, well, that's what I'm asking you to do. You know, ones where there's a genetic mix,
okay,
they're still being born out in the rivers. You know, I would call those natural origin fish.
Okay.
Native origin fish would be ones where there hasn't been any genetic integration with hatcheries.
Sure. Yeah.
So I assume when you say wild population, and those, and you'll, you know, look at the risk, because it kind of goes to Lorna's question too.
So this is partly semantic, partly it's philosophical, and partly biological here. So, yeah. So I've chosen to use the word wild. So the agency has adopted the terminology natural origin fish. Natural origin fish are born in the gravel or hatched in the gravel in a river. Hatchery origin fish are ones that are obviously the origin from the hatchery. So that talks about the place where these fish originated from, but doesn't necessarily speak to their ancestry.
Yes.
So when I'm making reference to wild populations, I'm talking about populations that basically are populations that could have had a mix of both hatchery and hatchery and natural origin fish in it, but the population, that hatchery population in the river, is a functional population. It's an entity that is responding to the natural environment. It's responding to the vagaries of living in a wild environment. So that's what I'm making reference to. Some of those populations could be responding to the environment, but they could have been initially made up of hatchery fish that have basically have had fitness to operate in that system. And as I mentioned earlier, there are systems that may appear to be functional populations, that they may have a natural spawning, but if there's not a lot of production coming out of that river, then one has to evaluate whether that's a wild population or not. So it's terminology. I didn't want to say natural population. I chose the word wild for that purpose, but wild can consist of both hatchery and natural origin fish.
Thanks. That's much clearer. I appreciate that.
And Commissioner Smith, would you mind waiting until Dr. Warheit concludes his presentation? I think there'll be other questions. Would you mind, or would you want to go now?
Oh, it's just a clarification. So we can tell genetically, definitively, or there's room for a fair amount of debate still, even based on genetics on these different runs.
Depends upon what kind of, if you're talking about telling apart between hatchery and natural origin fish, it depends upon what kind of hatchery you're talking about. So we manage hatcheries basically two different ways. We have what's referred to as segregated hatchery programs, where the hatchery is intended to be isolated and separate from the wild population. It doesn't always work that way. We get leakage from that into wild populations. But if those populations are genetically distinct to begin with, or became genetically distinct through the segregated hatchery production, then we can potentially tell those two populations apart. In other words, we can take a look at a fish and maybe make a determination whether that fish is has two natural origin parents, one natural origin parent, one hatchery origin parent, or two natural origin parents that basically are hatchery origin parents that spawned in naturally. But the other kind of hatcheries that we have are integrated hatchery production, where we intentionally mix hatchery fish with wild fish. And we intentionally take natural origin fish and use them as broodstock. And we allow hatchery origin fish to spawn in the wild. these populations are now functioning as a single population. And in that case, we cannot tell them apart unless we have done extensive parentage analysis where we've genotyped all the hatchery parents, and we have a good idea through carcass surveys what the wild parents are. There's a potential we'd be able to identify who the parents are, but that's due to a statistical analysis, not through differences in the genetics, just differences in parents.
Thank you. Good explanation.
So I only have one more point to make and then switch it back to Ron, is that, and this goes back to Vice Chair Baker's question. No HMPs are going to be worked on until we have finished the technical procedures document. So we work through the technical procedures document, and when that's completed, then work begins on the HMPs. Now, there's possible some work can be done on the HMPs before the technical procedures document is, because the HMPs overlap in many regards with hatchery genetic management plans, HGMPs. So obviously that kind of work can just be moved over. But the idea about how many fish, the production levels and the operations that are associated with production levels and broodstock management, which will be results from this technical procedure, that will begin after the technical procedures document is current. Like I said, it's going to take about a year to do that. It may take upwards of 5 years to complete the HMPs, starting from the highest priority ones, which we delineate in the policy itself. I also want to emphasize one more thing. The flow diagram, which we don't need to go back to, that is part of the policy. Again, I want to emphasize that's an example. The actual technical procedures document may not look like that flow diagram, but it'll have all of the important elements of that flow diagram. But that is part of the policy. And so is the figure caption, which is more extensive than a normal figure caption. It tries to explain what that flow diagram is and what's going on in that. And it gives an example of how things would operate. Okay, thank you.
So we'll move on to and thank you, Ken, that was a good section. I appreciate that. Move on to the proposed calendar. Fish committee meeting occurred on the 28th, just a couple of days ago, to consider recommendations to full commission. Here we are today, commission to consider approving a draft of your policy 3619 for the purposes of conducting a review under SEPA, and an expected schedule and process to reach final decisions on those changes, this schedule. During the month of February, staff would complete a SEPA assessment and do some requested outreach, as well as some additional requests of ourselves to tribes under co-management, and those tribes that have requested government-to-government meetings on this topic. We would try to fit all of those in the month of February. During March 3rd through the 18th would be the two-week period for the public review of the SEPA assessment. March 19th through the 24th, we would review that public comment and finalize the SEPA assessment. And then March 25th through the 27th commission meeting, we would discuss with all of that information with the fish committee. They consider that, and then the full commission with a hearing from the public and a final discussion by the commission for a possible adoption in April of this policy. So before I move on, maybe I could Chair, with your permission, see if any of the writing team participants had any comments or questions before we move to full-on questions.
Vice Chair Baker has a question.
Yeah, I was only an observer of the writing team, but sometimes I have to get hit on the head to really understand something. So I'm going to re-ask my earlier question, if you don't mind, because we have at one place in this new policy, which actually has a new number and everything, says we're superseding the old policy, that this new policy is in effect. And then we have a another place in our new policy that says for all of our operations and all of that, we're going to go back to 2018. And then the third thing that we have, which I really like, is the new development of the flowchart and the technical procedures document with the tribes. So what I'm trying to get my fingers on, and I'm really sorry if I'm just being dense, is aside from the development of that year-long process, does this new policy change anything immediately?
Chair Carpenter, Commissioner Baker, I would say the thing that it changes is it highlights and finalizes the direction from the Commission on the Southern Resident Orca Initiative and prioritizes the finalization of the risk assessment framework and then those HMPs that would align with those facilities that are conducting that additional production value so that we assure that from a solid policy grounding and operational procedures perspective, we are assuring ourselves that that added production meets all the criteria that the commission has asked us to put forward while we operate our facilities.
Okay.
There are likely other elements as well, but that's the one that sticks out to me most prominently.
Okay, Ron, we have two hands up, Commissioner Anderson and Commissioner McIsaac. Then I have a question, and we have double-digit individuals signed up for public comment, so keeping time in mind, this is very important. Commissioner Anderson.
I'll be brief. You know, I think the process since the last meetings in November, December have been positive, have yielded some positive results. The various discussions have been very helpful, a lot of listening and communicating between the writing group and putting together that draft, trying to pick up the different public comments as well as input from the tribes, I think has yielded a document with significant direction. And so I'm looking forward to getting that out and having some further comments today.
Okay, we have several hands up now. We have Commissioner McIsaac and then Commissioner Smith and then Molly, Commissioner Linville, and then I may have something to say. Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I might ask Ron to put back up the draft, the CEPA review draft, so I can make a point and try to give another answer to Commissioner Baker's question about will anything change here? So the idea here is that there is a new policy with a lot of new language in it. The key paragraph on policy guideline 4 revolving the scientific risk assessment and structured decision-making policy is to phase in over the course of a year a pretty sophisticated risk assessment and decision-making process. So that is something that won't change until after about a year. But I would say there are many changes associated with this policy that would come into play if we have a CEPA review that results in an assessment of environmental impacts not being that significant. Maybe they'll see it significant. Let's suppose it doesn't, and this policy is adopted. The policy would then say, go forward over the next year and develop this new analytical paradigm and decision-making structure. But the purpose statement of the policy would now be different. It's broadened. I would say from the tribal co-management perspective, there would be a significant change. And Ron, if you scroll down to, if you could scroll down to those tribal paragraphs, those paragraphs that have tribal co-management involvement, those were not in the old policy. And so there's a recognition of mitigation hatcheries. That was not in the old policy. If you'll continue to scroll down to the last paragraph in policy guideline number 4, where I think the essence of Commissioner Baker's question is, because there are other changes here from the old policy that would come into play and now be the new policy of the commission if this is adopted while we're waiting for the year-long process for a technical procedures document. For example, I'll rattle off a few other minor ones before I get to this one. There wasn't an adaptive management section in the old policy. Now we would have one. There's a policy guideline to take care of the best of the wild populations a little bit better. The old policy had some business in there about fishery management. But I think the essence of your question is what really happens in our hatchery production over the course of the year while we're waiting for this technical procedures document. So the paragraph here says the director shall approve new HMPs. And that means essentially over the course of the next year, as described in this technical procedures document, when it is completed. Until then, the HMPs that are in play now, the hatchery programs that are in place that were in effect before the motion in 2018 that suspended HSRG guidelines, shall remain intact, except, and this was not mentioned, so I want to make it clear here, except as modified in accordance with any watershed-specific policies or initiatives adopted or modified by the commission since that date, such as the Columbia River Fishery Management Policy, the Willapaw Bay Salmon Fishery Management Policy, and the 2008 Southern Resident Orca Prey Initiative. So let me seize on that last one first. In 2018, when those guidelines, those SRG standards, not necessarily the principles, but the scientific standards were suspended, it allowed the department to go forward with some initiatives and to enhance hatchery production to benefit southern resident killer whales, orca. We heard at one of our previous meetings that there's been good progress made since 2018 on that. The commission asked for something significant, maybe in the area of 50 million smolts, and I think we heard something like 20 million or 25 million has been negotiated with the National Marine Fisheries Service and all the folks, and there's movement on that. If we would go all the way back to June 14th for every program, we'd have to rescind those. And a Willapaw Bay example is we have suspended to preserve options the hatchery program changes for Forks Creek hatchery that would otherwise go all the way back to 2018. That would amount to a reduction of some 3 million fall Chinook at Forks Creek hatchery. And so the Willapaw Bay business has been a subject of commission debate that's got us in a situation different than it was before then. Columbia River policy doesn't have a whole lot of specifics in there other than advocating for more fish in general. So I'm trying to answer your question as specifically as I can, Commissioner Baker, from the perspective of all the dialogue that's gone into these current changes. And if this goes through between now and a year from now, we will have a new policy with, in some phrasing, a little bit new attitude and some other changes as well beyond the big one that we're waiting for that develops HMPs for all the programs. I don't know if that helped or not, but that was my attempt.
Thank you, Commissioner McKenzie. All right, Commissioner Smith and then Commissioner Linville. And Commissioner Anderson, is your hand up intentionally or no? Okay.
No.
Commissioner Smith, please. Commissioner Linville, second.
So this is a SEPA question and kind of pertains in part to that schedule we were looking at. Because I see that there was allowance for only more or less a 2-week comment period, I'm assuming there's an anticipation that this is going to be a checklist accompanied by a DNS. And is this a programmatic review that will then be followed by a specific, you know, project level review once this year-long program is developed? And so I'm just trying to get an idea of SEPA. It seems to me that this, if there aren't any actual in-water changes implemented in this next year as a result of us adopting this policy, then to me, proper SEPA review is programmatic to be followed by, like I said, specific kind of project level review. Is there somebody on the team that can talk to those SEPA questions? Because I think we need to make sure we get that right.
So I can attempt to, and if Joe Pinesco wants to weigh in, I'd be more than happy to yield to him. Joe, do you want to go?
Sure. Let me address that highly. So there's been, again, also with caution to not revealing attorney-client privilege communications that have occurred between our office and the program staff. The proposed timeline is not really a rigid timeline that would prejudge department staff's determination on the SEPA analysis. So while that timeline might be hoping for a DNS or MDNS outcome, that it doesn't guarantee it. Staff will be free to conduct their evaluation. And if their evaluation looks at this and decides, oh, it requires a determination of significance in an EIS, then you know that is still an option for department staff to follow. But there is, you know, as the additional documentation and development of documents and scientific analysis to inform further decision making that Dr. Warheit describes, there is an express intent to conduct additional SEPA analysis at those later steps.
So, and just to continue with what Joe Pinesco just said, the intent is to not have a separate SEPA on every HMP. So, that would be impossible to do. But the intent is to go through the SEPA process for this document. All of the activities that the document discusses, in addition to this new document that we're going to produce, the themes that Dr. McIsaac just went through in particular, those would be subject to the SEPA evaluation currently on this current document. But the idea is effectively, in the way I envision it, is that the technical procedures document would be something that would try to capture all of the range of potential environmental risks associated with our hatchery operations. So that SEPA, that document should, in my mind, go through greater SEPA scrutiny than the current document is going to go through, because there'll be more details in terms of how we're going to deal with these trade-offs, what kind of science we're going to use. All of that is, to me, where the rubber meets the road. And if we do a good job explaining all this, then hopefully we can come up with a determination of non-significance from that. But just as Joe Pinesco said, I'm not going to foreshadow any of this, because right now I have a general idea what that procedures document is going to look like, but I can't tell you. I'm one person. This is going to be written by many people. So it's at that point that a lot of this critical work is going to be done. And hopefully if we do a good job and we get through and it's passed, then it'll be clear to everyone, staff, commission, the public, how our hatchery is going to be operating in terms of production. Does that help? You're muted.
Yes, I'm not going to dive into any deeper into this right now, but, you know, I used to tell project managers, you know, when I was looking over these SEPA decisions, you know, sometimes it makes sense to just step forward and volunteer an EIS, even if, you know, it's questionable whether one would be required, because then, you know, you're anyway an upset on that.
Okay, Commissioner Linville, please.
So I generally don't trust flowcharts that I can understand. And so, Dr. Warhite, I understood everything you said. So now I don't know how to feel about that, but thank you for that. There is a lot of clarity around that, and I appreciated that. My question is, I think maybe I'm tracking Commissioner Baker a little bit on this. One of my fatal flaws I now see is I have been depending on the Fish Committee members to disseminate all of this information for me. And now I feel like my learning curve is back. So I'm just wondering, with the absence of them, some of those members, can we just get the pre-June 14th document, whatever that is, so that we know what we're working from, for the next year as the SEPAs roll out? And I'm sure we have it. I'm sure I have it. If it could be, you know, this is what we're working from right now, so that I know that, I would appreciate that if that's doable.
Go ahead.
Chair Carpenter, Commissioner Linville, I think that just to be very clear, many of the conversations that we've had through the Fish Committee and the writing group is how easy or difficult it is to find all of the information relative to the principles and standards that were adopted in the previous policy. So it's going to be difficult. I think more than anything is that we have been working through preparing, agreeing with co-managers and seeking NOAA approval on our hatchery and genetic management plan. Some of those contain explicit information relative to the HSRG standards and guidelines. Some of them don't, but we as a culture within the agency still have that in our heads from the early 2000s and are trying to live by that. What we're trying to do is develop a document that pulls the science into that without venturing into the policy realms, so that we can continue to operate facilities properly and evaluate those risks and benefits to all of us and all things as we move forward. So it might be difficult. The old policy is still online if you wanted to reread that policy, but to get you all of the information, I could give you some websites to go to, some pretty lengthy documents to scan through or read, but it's scattered in a lot of different locations. Maybe I'll stop there, see if Dr. Warhite has anything additional to add, but I think it's a difficult thing just to point to one place.
So I agree with that. The policy, the current policy that's still in effect, except the first three objectives, makes reference to HSRG, Hatchery Science Review Group. I'm a member of HSRG, although HSRG sort of as a functioning body doesn't exist anymore. And that group had published several documents that had basically recommendations, talks about threshold values. So our policy points to the HSRG, okay? That I, in retrospect, looking at it now, 11, 12 years later, that's not a good idea. Ron is absolutely right. We should try to write a policy and then a procedures document that's self-contained. May have scientific references that you may want to go to, but try to keep everything together. And that's, I think, one of the real positive aspects of this new policy is that it allows us for you to ask that question 10 years from now, and you can look back at this policy and know exactly what we're talking about.
I appreciate that. And I can understand how that all came to be. So I hope you're both willing to be phone-a-friends for questions around this, because thank you.
Certainly. And the other thing is that there's a lot of angst among co-managers about HSRG, how it came about, how it was linked to certain operations, those types of things that or seem to diminish treaty rights. Those are my words, not theirs. And so it'll be nice to develop this document in conjunction with them, so it's truly a co-manager document on what we're going to do, how we're going to do it, and that it is in one place for all of us to reference back to for future operations and decision-making. That's similar to tribal law, where the foundation of relationships is grounded through the court system. And although I don't want to go to court on this document with anybody, I think having that foundational document about hatchery operations and how we're going to make decisions is critical to all of us.
Ron and Ken, I have one question statement, and then I'm going to come back to you, Commissioner Thorburn, to discuss the scheduling conflict if you choose to do that. Just a placeholder. I don't know. I don't want to bring this up for today's discussion. I think it could be too lengthy, and I don't know if any of us are prepared. But Ron, I assume internally you've had some discussions regarding financial / budgetary requirements that are going to change in short order, I think, with this policy. And certainly once we get to a joint policy with the co-managers and we start moving forward with hatchery implementation features and more productivity, have you had some internal discussions? And I'd like to put a placeholder out there to have some maybe at the Fish Committee at the appropriate time.
Chair Carpenter, I look forward to those conversations. We have talked about how the new shaping of HSRG has been successful and could be more successful with additional funding and infrastructure changes, those types of things. We've done very well through our camp section. You've heard about the capital budget. Those types of large-scale capital budgets are needed for 10 biennia in a row to bring our facilities up to proper maintenance and modernization to be able to function to meet all of the objectives. And we look forward to that conversation and continuing the work to receive the appropriate amount of funding to maintain and operate our facilities.
Thank you for that. Commissioner Thorburn, I saw a note that you had a scheduling conflict. Did you have a recommendation that we should bring it forward now?
Well, as I mentioned yesterday when we postponed the executive session, that I do have another meeting scheduled where we have another important topic. I know the public's interest in both of this one and the next one. I think it's going to pretty much run up against my appointment, my meeting. It's not a meeting that I can reschedule. And so I was wondering if we could cancel the executive session.
Comments from Commission and or Joe Pinesco and staff for that matter?
Chair, if you'd like my first take on that. There are some topics for executive session that, in my belief, the director and deputy director may desire to push forward with the remaining members of the commission. They're pretty timely, but to the extent that there were some legal advice, litigation risk topics that Commissioner Thornburn had desired to receive some input on, of course, we can postpone those to a future meeting where she is available.
Okay, that seems like Kelly, did you want to comment?
Very similar. We've got a single item. I don't know if Deputy Windrope is available, but we have a single item we would like to talk about today. And I think something that we could then follow up individually with Commissioner Thornburn afterwards to make sure she's fully aware of the conversation that occurred.
All right. We will have a condensed version of the executive session. Commissioner Smith, did you choose to comment?
I was just going to wade in and say, particularly for the benefit of the two new commissioners, I hope we can go ahead with an executive session. Sounds like we're going to do that. So, okay.
We're going to do that. Okay, Nikki, go ahead and we're going to open public comment. Go ahead and do the preamble and then let's get started. How many people do we have?
Well, I've got pre-signed up 12, but right now I've only got two hands raised, so we'll just roll into that.
Let's get started because we are behind again.
We'll now take public comment. As a reminder, everyone gets 3 minutes. If you're pre-registered, we ask that you still raise your hand so we can see you in the queue. Everyone is currently muted, so if you have a comment, raise the hand. If you're on the computer, the raise hand button appears under your name. If you're on the phone, please press *9 and wait to hear you've been unmuted. See, so first two are Alan Chapman and Greg King. Go ahead, Alan.
Good morning, Chairman Carpenter and commissioners. I want to support the changes in policy being considered. I still would like to list a few concerns. One, though it is implied in the flow chart, that flow chart speaks only to this process of HSRG, wild stock, natural stock balance. And there's a whole nother area which talks about the function of hatcheries is produce adult fish, not juveniles. So there's a whole other situation there where you're trying to manage hatcheries to make sure they are producing adults, which are the benefits. And the benefits here seem to be buried, and I appreciate the number and methods of releasing juveniles are important, and it's a whole other section, but to list that hatcheries produce juveniles is sort of misleading things. My own pet peeves from some years of experience is this focus on wild fish, and it's a lack of recognition that for good or ill, the humans are in charge, and you want to be able to have the science to understand what your actions, the result of your actions. But society has a whole lot of different needs with respect to housing, jobs, shelter, all that other stuff that are overwhelming. And until the department has some control over land use policies and can identify sort of priority corridors that need to be preserved for wild fish, we have to deal with what we've got and try to get the best we can out of it. And I guess there's a difference between salmon and sparrows. There is a great value to salmon returning for the human population. The sparrows might be an indicator of problems, but they are not directly involved in the benefits to humans. And I would be happy to take any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Chapman? Seeing none, Alan, always good to hear from you. Have a good day. Next, Nikki.
Next, we have Greg King, followed by caller 4932. Go ahead, Greg.
Again, good morning, Chair Carpenter, Commission, staff,
My name is Greg King, representing Lower Columbia River Chapter of Puget Sound Anglers. I'm not going to debate Dr. Warheit. I'm refreshed, very refreshed to see that we're moving forward with this. This has been a back and forth since June of 2018, and it's refreshing to see this moving forward. I just a little bit of history on salmon in Washington State for the new commissioners. We have had over 120 years of hatcheries. We've had over 450 billion eggs transferred all over the state. We have egg boxes. So we have a pretty strong genetic of hatchery fish in our populations, I would say. I'd like to point to Project Genesis on the Callis River. I think it's one of the greatest salmon experiments on the West Coast. It is where we have three dams and no fish passage, and we have transferred hatchery fish into the upper watershed, and we are seeing results that hatchery fish left to do on their own can produce offspring. We had over 12,000 natural cohos come back to the watershed this year. Amazing. But these will take 400 to 500 years to fully recover the abundance of hatchery, wild fish. And I just want you guys to look at that and look at the time and effort that Tacoma and the department have put in on Project Genesis and the collection facility that they have used for that, because we're now seeing the tribes doing this same supplementation program above Grand Coulee. And I think it'd be a great thing to do on the Snake River too. We have to get those collection facilities. But the point here is that hatchery fish can do it. You know, we're spending a lot of money. We got almost 40 years of so-called recovery on the Columbia River. We started in 1984 releasing wild spring chinook and wild steelhead. We had a little card. We measured the dorsal fin. It was so big you let it go. And those times have changed now. But 40 years and $18 billion. And you know, our tax dollars are getting sucked by these scientists that and no offense to Dr. Warheit at all, but it's getting a little bit too much. You know, how much are you going to spend on recovery? When we got the tool right there, it's hatchery fish. Okay, we need to just, I'm not talking about like Johnny Appleseed and like my colleague Mr. Smith talks about. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking within reason, you know. And I think with this policy changes and everything, that this is a step forward and a great step forward, because remember, Larry, the time is clicking on this. We talked about this. You even said it. We have 10 years. What are we at now? Six? Then another year? So anyway, those are my comments, and thank you, staff, for your presentation. It's a great one.
Greg, message received. Thank you. Have a good day. Next, Nikki.
Next, I've got caller 4932. Go ahead. Please state your name for the record. Make sure to unmute yourself.
Hello. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Thank you. This is Ross Barkhurst, leader of the Willapa Basin Ecosystem Review Team. I have looked at some things that may relate to this. I tried to follow the tortuous path about, are we going to look before we leap on hatcheries within the next year or not? Concern that I've raised is that at the end of an advisor meeting last year, we were handed a sheet where, hey, we're putting X million more Chinook out of the Maysville hatchery. It sits in an area of the bay that gets very little circulation and is overgrazed. And so that was done without the benefits of this hatchery policy, which looks like someday it's going to be set up properly. In my former business, we had a situation which you would want in a nuclear plant where it's certain circumstances you're required to look and have a committee review an unreviewed safety question. I've also sat in on budgets. And last budget I saw, we were going to shut down the NEMA and the Forks Creek Hatchery. So I see an unreviewed safety question here. We're going to put 2 million more Chinook where there may be a significant habitat problem. We're going to take 3.2 million away where we have the best returns in the bay and see what happened. And in 2 years, we'll be through with TPD, and then we'll see whether we should have done it or not. And I think Ron Warren's question was, well, some of this needs to be looked at now based on the 2018. If you're trying to help the orcas rule, you ought to look now. And I would certainly root for, if we're trying to help the orcas and the extra Chinook smolts in the Maysel were named after helping the orcas. If we're trying to help the orcas, we need to make sure we don't have a sequence of events set up here where we starve them to death. And that's my number one priority. My number two priority is if it were to go that route, it's just off the recreational priority on anything. Subject to your questions, thank you.
Ross, thank you for your comments. Next, Nikki.
Next, we have Lisa Olson, followed by David Moskowitz. Go ahead, Lisa.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks again for letting me speak. I want to apologize if I'm off the beat here a little bit, but it sounds to me like having this hatchery policy be statewide, which is, I believe, what Mr. Warren said on Thursday at the committee meeting, would put the Willapa system in kind of a difficult position. We've made some headway on releasing fish, and I think it's pretty clear that the Willapa system is kind of a perfect place to make fish. We've been a hatchery system for about 60 years, and I think we can be part of the solution on not only the orca situation by just simply putting some more fish out, but also, you know, keeping in mind, again, I know I keep bouncing up and down about this, but our rural areas are fish dependent, not only at the ports and things, you know, with the commercial fishery, but also with sport fishery. So I really hope that that this is taken into consideration, and maybe if it's a possibility that the Willapa system can be have a bit of a different set of guidelines in the hatchery policy, because I think it's a completely different animal than Puget Sound. So thank you so much.
Lisa, thank you for your comments. And so you know, Willapa Bay is our next agenda item this morning.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to hang on. Thanks, Larry.
Thank you. Okay, next, Nikki, please.
Next is David Moskowitz, followed by Jamie Glasgow. Go ahead, David.
Thank you very much, Nikki. And Chair Carpenter, Co-Chair Baker, members of the commission, and Director Sussman, greatly appreciate the opportunity to comment on this policy. It is a long and winding road. We're still troubled by the very beginning of this. I think maybe we're thinking about when you build a house and you start off with a bad foundation, it's hard to correct that. And we still believe that the foundation for this change was improper and out of sequence. And it's going to trouble this process all the way through. The 2018 agenda, topic on the commission's agenda was hatchery reform policy and scientific review group briefing, public comment, and possible guidance. The staff asked for action requested. They request consideration of three potential commission actions, which were recognizing the role of hatcheries as prey for the killer whales, clarifying and emphasizing potential to increase production for programs primarily affecting stabilizing populations, and also provide the staff the opportunity to brief the commission if policy guidance is needed, if additional policy guidance is needed. Now, the result was that there was a motion to initiate review, and it also put policy guidelines 1, 2, and 3 of the HSRG on hold. That's action, not guidance. And if we look at comparison of how the Columbia River fishery policies were set up for this policy 3620, you know, the existing policy and regulation were not suspended during a 2-year staff review into whether 3620 was working for Columbia River fisheries. So we still ask the question, what is the evidence that the HSRG criteria and the previous policy were not contributing to successful action by the department. And if you indeed look at the presentations from the staff at that time, there's been a steady increase in accomplishments under the prior 3619. And so here we are looking at a timeline for adoption with a lot of uncertainties, tribal code management meetings and what may come from that and how the public gets to look at it, a SEPA review, and a technical guidance document that is not going to be finished for another year. It's troubling to us. The policy change will unseat ESA and NEPA review that's been completed for Puget Sound and Columbia River HGMPs. It's going to require reinitiation of consultation for USV Oregon, Columbia River Management as well. And I guess I'd like to close, though. Those are all technical and legal things, but I want to get back to just the natural world here. You know, once you let hatchery fish out of the concrete and barbed wire, you have no control over what happens to them. And as they migrate downstream, as they rear, as they graze in the ocean pasture and then return to fresh water, there's no proof that hatcheries that increase hatchery production of Chinook will actually increase available prey for orca whales. There's ample evidence that increased hatchery production does depress wild populations and productivity, that hatchery fish do attract increased predator densities. And furthermore, that the low ocean and marine productivity cycles we have seen are likely to dampen hatchery fish survival in that environment and negate any supposed increases in actual adult returns. We believe that there's a misplaced faith and reliance on a failed technology that's been in place in the Northwest since the 1870s.
You got time to...
Thank you. I'm going to close right now. I thank you. Bear with me for just about 30 seconds. The fact that we basically treat these fish as if we can be exhibiting animal husbandry for a wild animal as if it were a crop, and it ignores what we do not know about the magical life of wild salmon homing to their natal streams and the complex dance of mate selection that happens in those rivers. We eliminate that with hatchery production, and we always will. I really appreciate, thank you for letting me go over for a second. We think that the money spent on hatchery fish is a lost opportunity to really address the larger issues at stake here. We will continue to be involved in this process, and we are happy to answer any questions from the commissioners. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for your comments today, David. Nikki, next, please.
Next, I've got Jamie Glasgow, followed by Butch Smith. Go ahead, Jamie.
Thanks, Nikki. Chair Carpenter and Commission, I'm Jamie Glasgow, Director of Science for Wild Fish Conservancy. At past commission meetings, we've raised concerns about the 3619 rewrite process as it relates to public transparency, and these concerns continue. The proposed changes to the state's hatchery and fishery management policy have significant implications for past and ongoing federal, state, tribal, and public efforts to recover wild salmon and steelhead. Yet the public remains largely unaware of the proposed changes and their implications. For example, in April of 2020, about 10 months ago, I requested 3619 information from the department through a public records request. That request has yet to be fulfilled by the state, with the latest delay pushed out to March of 2021. While the governor has issued a statutory waiver and extension of the Public Records Act due to COVID, I'd like to think he didn't intend to create a wall behind which public records could be withheld for up to a year or more. We'd ask that the commission's 3619 rewrite schedule accommodates such delays in the state's response to public records requests so that the public can provide fully informed feedback when given the chance. I also wanted to touch on something I heard several times today, and that was the implication that we can essentially write off recovery of wild populations of salmon or steelhead that have been impacted by past and ongoing hatchery mismanagement. that is where hybridization has been allowed to occur between hatchery and wild fish. Hatchery reform science, as I understand it, and much of this is supported in the 2020 review by WDFW, the Hatchery Reform Science Review, demonstrates that it is beneficial to the resiliency and ultimately to the recovery of those wild or natural origin populations of salmon and steelhead to prevent future genetic and ecological interactions with hatchery fish, especially with first generation harvest program hatchery fish. I believe we have time for questions. I appreciate your effort and interest in this issue. I think it's incredibly important, and look forward to having an opportunity to provide additional comments in the future.
Jamie, this is Larry Carpenter. I just want to say I knew nothing about the records request or the delays, but the commission stands for as open a process as we possibly can. I hope you know that. You've participated in that. And we want to continue to be as open and candid as we can. So I hope you'll hear what you get, what you need, and get back to us, because we're here to listen and appreciate your comments.
I really appreciate you saying that, Chair Carpenter. And just to be crystal clear, these are unusual times, and there is a governor mandate for that reason. My request is simply that that the timeline and schedule for the 3619 review consider this situation and accommodate that delay, so that when we are able to provide comments through SEPA, we actually have the information that we've requested from the state almost a year ago. Thank you.
Okay, well, hold on 1 minute. Commissioner Kuntz either has a question or comment. Unmute yourself, Fred, please.
I got it. Jamie, what I was going to ask, and you don't have to answer right now, maybe you could contact the commission afterwards. I understand your dilemma with both the PDR and also the pandemic slowing these things down. It's really nobody's, I think, fault. Could you suggest a timeline that you think would be, appropriate under the conditions of the place we find ourselves in today? And again, you could contact the commission afterwards, because I, would like to review that.
Commissioner Kuntz, thanks. Thanks for that. I would be happy to. I think in part the answer to that question depends on when the documents that we've requested are finally provided to us. But let me think a little more about that, and I will send a response to the commission through Nikki. Thanks.
Thank you, Jamie. Next, Nikki.
Got Butch Smith followed by Conrad Gall. Go ahead, Butch.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Commission. First of all, my name is Butch Smith, President of the Owako Charter Association. I'm also elected official with the Port of Owako Commission. Truly appreciate the commission and Dr. Seswin, and unfortunately, I got to give him a compliment today, Ron Warren, and all the staff for their hard work on this issue. This issue started over 2.5 years ago, and I would imagine I and Ron Warren have made many WDF dartboards now because of our questioning on the HSRG policy that started so many years ago to look at some of its downfalls. I will tell you that from my experience, and I think I'm pretty attuned to salmon issues for the last 30 years, and I can tell you this particular process is certainly a lot bigger and certainly a lot more transparent than the HSRGO policy that was adopted in 2008 or 2009. I can tell you that. 1,000% better and more transparent. I think that the one thing that Ron Warren said that I took to heart, I'm also on the Billy Frank Coalition, with the tribes, non-tribal coalition, and I also sit on a northern hatchery coalition with tribal and non-tribal members. And one thing that I can say for sure, this policy, HHRG, when it came into play, was basically shoved down both the tribal and non-tribal throats of the people in Washington with hardly any comment, any reflection, any co-management. And I think that this, in fact, is one of the moving this policy, the new policy forward, would go a long ways into mending those fences and the feelings how both sides feel. It is a policy. It is a policy of choices. Do we choose to recover salmon in, 100 years in some cases, with, shutting the whole coast and Puget Sound down to all fishing, or do we choose to take it to 150 years, example, where we have fishing, where we can maintain our coastal communities and our tribal communities? I mean, those are choices that we didn't have at the time of the original policy. And I think that in itself was hugely a crime by the policy that was adopted in 2009. I also, would like to say that having a policy that's talking about foundations that's frozen time, based on environmental conditions and ocean conditions and everything that was frozen in 2002, and not having any environmental variations brought up to date, is huge. You had a presentation yesterday on seals and sea lions. You saw what the population it was in 2002. And now you see what the population is in 2021. Those factors aren't added in the old policy. We've lost 170 million production statewide, 63 million alone in Puget Sound. Now, this is El Waco math, so be careful. 63 million in Puget Sound translates to about 630,000 fish. Less returning adults than we have now. You add that 33 million that the seals or sea lions are eating, you're just a tick under a million fish, just a tick under a million less adult salmon swimming around in Puget Sound that we once had. Now, everybody knows, before Larry was Chair Carpenter was a commissioner, we used to tease him about Area 7 and the blackmouth fisheries. Never was able to be touched. It always fished. You always had winter fisheries. I mean, what do you guys got now? You have no winter fisheries. You have Area 7 being, and all the areas in Puget Sound, as well as the coast. So I think at the time, during the hatchery hating times of the 2000s, early 2000s, it might have seemed like a pretty good scientific theory, but like all science, it's got to be evolving. It's got to be changing. And that's what we're doing here. And I appreciate Dr. Warheit's candidness. And I know he's been on the hot seat by his own community and others from that meeting that went way back in 2018. I sympathize with that. But I appreciate his honesty that started this conversation. So in my opinion, it's time. It's time to move on. This is a science-based policy. It will be a science. We're not abandoning any science. We're improving on the science. 500-600 years ago, how many scientists believed that you would sail off on the edge of the earth and go down a big waterfall? Okay. And then there was a science that said the world was round, fortunately the round scientist won on that one. And I can tell you, the previous policy, just come down and look at the coastal communities. Look what it's done to the coastal communities. Look what it's done to the tribal communities. Look what it's done when we didn't have choices. As a fisherman, and in everything I've done, representing the state or representing myself, we want wild fish. We want habitats to be fixed and thrive. But the truth of the matter is, as human beings, we have done things that aren't habitat friendly. And for that, we've had mitigation hatcheries, we have tribal obligations, and we're trying the best we can. But just about as fast as we fix habitat around Puget Sound, we lose it on the other side. And so hatcheries are an important part to our coastal communities, to our tribal communities, to feeding the orca whales, and to the way of the Northwest. So let's not forget that, yes, the fishermen that I represent want as many wild fish as we can. But fortunately, I sent you a paper, some of you commissioners, a document, the Lackey document. We have 44 or 60% less wild habitat today than we did 50 years ago. Okay, we can't even feed the whales on the habitat that we have left. So please, let's move this policy forward for public review. It's time. I appreciate all the hard work that Ron Warren, Dr. Warheit, and the staff did on this. I think it is it passes the red face test in many ways, and it's just an improvement on the old policy. Thank you very much.
Butch, thank you for your comments. Have a good weekend. Next, Nikki, please.
Next is Conrad Gowell, followed by Ron Gardner, and those are the last two I have.
Thank you.
Conrad.
Chair Carpenter, Co-Chair Baker, Director Suswind, and members of the commission. My name is Conrad Gowell. I'm a biologist with the Wild Fish Conservancy. Thanks for the ability to provide testimony today. I wanted to draw your attention to a letter submitted to the governor's office by multiple organizations on the 3619 matter. These organizations included Long Live the Kings, the Conservation Angler, Trout Unlimited, the Wild Fish Conservancy, the Wild Salmon Center, and the Wild Steelhead Coalition. This letter was sent earlier this month expressing five specific concerns. Briefly, those concerns were the abandonment of science, the difference between hatchery genetic management plans and recovery planning goals, wise use of public resources in these challenging times, the dynamics with the public process that Jamie Glasgow mentioned earlier, and others. And then this issue of the State Environmental Policy Act that I know you've all been digging into and trying to understand with more depth. If you haven't had a chance to review this letter, I urge you to do so to understand the details of these concerns. But in summary, the main point of the groups was to stop revisions of the 2009 hatchery and fishery reform policy and reinstating it in full until the Fish and Wildlife Commission addresses these fundamental issues with the policy rewrite. You know, what I'm sensing is that through a lot of the revisions that have taken place since this last issue was brought up, the policy mirrors the old one in many ways. And the adaptive management process that drives how that policy was supposed to be evaluated. One of the conclusions is of your own staff's report is that the old policy wasn't effectively implemented. We encourage the commission to have the department identify what failed and why, and so the same mistakes are not made moving forward. I appreciate your time here today, and I'm happy to answer any questions if they arise.
I don't see any, Conrad. Thank you for your comments today. Next, Nikki.
Lastly, we've got Ron Gardner. Go ahead, Ron.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay, thank you again, commissioners. You know, this is a very intense subject because you have the fours and the against. I want to go on record first saying I'm also on the Billy Frank Coalition Junior Coalition, and I'm also on the Northern Tribes Coalition, and I work intently with a lot of the tribes. And let's go back to June 2018 when this policy had the 3 points of HSRG removed or suspended. You got a letter from the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission, and I believe there were 20 tribes that signed on to that to remove HSRG from the policy. And I talk with a lot of tribal members and there is going to be no one size fits all in this policy. When you get to the co-manager's policy, it's going to be river by river, just like HGMPs. It's going to fall under HGMPs. There's no abandonment of science. The 2009 C3619 policy to me was built on a foundation of sand because no scientific paper was ever made for the basis to be rigorously or vetted by the scientific community to see if it was actual. The second part was there was no modeling produced. Now, of course, this has gone on. There's been a lot, and I'm not trying to discredit any of the biologists. I really appreciate Dr. Warhite coming forward with this newer paperwork. But I think we need to really make some statements here. Why are the orcas dying? They're starving. Nate's presentation yesterday, 82% of their diet is Chinook. You go and remove more Chinook, you're going to see more dying orcas. So I think we really got to take a look at this. And one thing also that's not being addressed is when hatcheries are letting go of the smolts, we're losing, per NOAA, over 10 million are not making it out of the rivers. So that needs to be an accountability. There needs to be something added for that extra 10 million plus. And I also want to go back to the seals. One more thing, there was a study done a few years ago, Puget Sound steelhead, between 8 and 9 of every 10 steelhead released on a tag release study, 8 to 9 out of every 10 ended up in scat, in seal scat. So this is a huge, huge problem. But if you go and don't move forward with trying to get the production where needed, river by river, which is where this is going to end up, there's no abandonment of science. We are going to go into having to do this. Some rivers can take it, can take a lot of hatchery production per Ms. Smith, and some can't. But it's going to have to be done smart. And I believe that's where we're headed. But I would like to say that Puget Sound Anglers State Board, we approve and want to see this policy move forward. We support your revisions, and we appreciate everything you're doing. Thank you.
Rod, thank you for your comments. That does wrap up the open public comment period. I see we have a hand up. Commissioner McKaysey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for Dr. Warhite, and then in the spirit of trying to open the dialogue on our next steps on this, I have a motion that I might want to put forward as well. But let me start with a question for Dr. Warhite. We had some testimony here about these six organizations that wrote a letter, and one of their concerns had to do with abandoning the science. And with proper respect to these six organizations, their letter, which we did receive and read early on, was relative to the November 6th draft. And they did not have the benefit of this new draft that came out of the Fish Committee process. But I would like to ask you about this draft that we're now have in front of us. Do you see this policy as, quote, abandoning the science about what is known about hatchery and wild genetics, or a scientific approach to risk assessment?
No, I don't. And I thought I had made reference to that when we were discussing the flowchart. The elements that that are in the current policy, in particular, guidelines 1, 2, and 3, in particular, guideline 1, are part of the risk assessment in this particular new policy, in this the flow diagram, the new draft policy. So I am going to be involved in drafting this technical procedures document. I'm going to be involved in designing this structured analytical way of looking at this. I will, for my contribution, I'm going to make sure that documentation of risks and evaluation of these hazards in reference to their probabilities and impacts is going to be part of our decision-making process. So I don't think that there's anything that is in how we currently do the work is going to be removed from how we're going to be doing the work here with this policy. I think that this new policy adds more science. We're going to be looking at ecological aspects here, but also allows us to explicitly look at the trade-offs that are involved with a decision on how many fish are being produced. So I'm focusing on this current policy that we worked on and discussed today. And so to answer your question directly, no, I don't think we're abandoning science. I think there's both biological and, as I said earlier, social science involved in the decision-making process.
Yeah, well, thank you for that answer. You did speak to it earlier, and I trust very much that you and the staff are going to be bringing the science to the table in that technical procedures document. Mr. Chairman, in the spirit of moving the dialogue forward, I can ask our executive assistant, Nikki, to put a motion up on the board.
Commissioner McIsaac, perhaps you could hold for just 1 minute. I see Commissioner Thorburn has her hand up. Would that be all right?
Sure, you bet.
Commissioner Thorburn.
Yeah, thank you. I think, Commissioner McIsaac, it does precede your motion. Just sort of returning to the flow analysis and kind of supporting Commissioner Linville's observation. Wow, a flow analysis that's really easy to follow. I appreciate it and like what's been put forward. As this is put together, the sort of flag that stands out to me is in risk analysis, risk is so subjective. And particularly, you point out that risk is going to involve both probability of the risk as well as magnitude of the risk. And I'm just thinking, as you move forward and we have all of the conversations, the stakeholder input, the public input, it would be valuable in my mind to designate, how those are weighted. because generally I think in subjectivity of risk assessment, magnitude tends to get a lot of weight over even sort of lower magnitude, higher probable risks. So just thinking about how the process moves forward and that risk analysis, risk assessment can continue to provoke lots of controversy. I think being clear about the weight toward magnitude and the weight toward probability would be helpful. Just a thought, Dr. Warhite.
Would you like to comment, Dr. Warhite?
We are going to try to do our best to make things as objective as possible. So we're going to try to remove as much subjectivity out of it. There's a lot of things one does that you are definitely aware of with how public health is administered through, any kind of a risk assessment. Anything that we're going to use that can be quantified is going to be quantified. The elements that are currently a part of the HSRG overall framework can still be used here. So, but at some point, you're right, there does need to be an assessment as to what is the probability, what is the impact, and there's definitely uncertainty throughout this process. That's part of the adaptive management aspect, too. If there's uncertainty, we're going to have to make decisions with that uncertainty, but hopefully the adaptive management process will, through time, reduce that uncertainty. We'll do our best to be as objective and transparent as possible.
Thank you for that explanation. Okay, I think back to Commissioner McIsaac, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if I could ask that Nikki put up that motion that I believe she has. There we go. Okay. So I would move that the commission approve the draft of policy 3619 revisions recommended by the Fish Committee for an assessment of environmental impacts under the State Environmental Policy Act process, as well as the recommended schedule for further steps and the policy 3619 review process. And if there's a second, I'd just like to say just a couple of words about it.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
This is Jim Anderson.
Okay. We had two of them, but we'll take Commissioner Thorburn first. Before we go, Jim, did you have your hand up? Did you want to comment on this?
No, I was just prepared to make a second.
Oh, yeah. Okay. We have a motion and a second. Go ahead. You have some further discussion, Commissioner McKenzie.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me say that I think this is a good draft that follows a pretty thorough process, and I'd encourage the commissioners to move this draft forward for the SEPA review for a couple of different reasons. The public process has been extensive, as we heard in testimony, starting to push 3 years now. Two public review drafts that brought forth some tribal co-manager input and much public input that did change the language in the various drafts as we've moved through to this one. And I'd like to thank in particular Ron Warren for all his good work and riding herd on the process through all these months and years. That's been quite a chore. With regard to the set aside of a separate process described by Dr. Warheit, this new language kind of amounts to high level policy guidance with the details of the individual hatchery program and management changes. Where the rubber hits the road, as Dr. Warheit described, it comes later after the technical procedures document details are developed. As a high level description of some changes, the draft contains several good points that go back to the original intent in 2018. And let me just emphasize four of them quickly here. It includes a broader purpose for our hatchery programs and better recognition of the benefits of our hatchery programs than the prior policy document, a little bit of a change of attitude, so to speak. Secondly, it strengthens tribal co-management. In the meetings with the tribal policy people on this issue, we learned about much dissatisfaction they had about the development and content of the prior policy. So I think there should be no question that this draft is an improvement with regard to its direct policy calls for better tribal co-management and a joint policy to be developed in the near future for the tribes that want to do that in the geographic areas that want to do that. Another important point is it really does enable some help for southern resident orca, and we did hear some good public testimony on that today. We heard some also back on December 18th. And December 4th and December 15th, when we were doing commercial whale watching regulations, many of the people came forward and said, we know you're going to do something about insufficient prey problem in the very near future. This policy provides some clear direction to try that and try to do something in the near future while we're waiting for the long, long term wild production from habitat improvements.
Commissioner McIsaac.
Yes.
We have two commissioners with their hands raised. First, Vice Chair Baker. Secondly, Commissioner Kuntz.
Can I just finish? I'm just about done here.
Sure. Go ahead, please.
Okay. So the third point is it helps the southern resident orca. The fourth point here, the last one, is that it has a continued commitment to strong scientific basis for evaluating the risks and conserving the important genetic resources. I won't go into that anymore. Dr. Warheit has done an excellent job describing that. It brings in-house those good HSRG principles and their analytical paradigm, so to speak, but also puts the policy decisions about how much risk to take in-house as in a different manner than relying on an HSRG policy standard. And I want to specifically recognize and compliment Dr. Warheit and any of the staff colleagues that he was involved with, bringing forth basically a concept and instituting an open, transparent, deliberative process. This is a real advancement, groundbreaking movement here. And it'll be fleshed out over the course of the next year, but I want to thank Dr. Warheit specifically. So I think we ought to move forward and approve this draft for analysis under SEPA.
Thank you, Commissioner McIsaac. We're going to go to Vice Chair Baker first and then to Commissioner Kuntz second. Vice Chair Baker, please.
Thank you, Chair Carpenter. I'm not sure if this is a question or comment. It might be both. I am fine and will have
things to say about this policy later on when the actual policy is before us. But I'm fine with moving it out for the SEPA analysis. The part of this motion that's concerning to me is that we are approving a schedule, which we have already earlier in this meeting said may need to be adapted for compliance with public records requests and just sort of may need to be adaptive generally. Yet another thing that we've begun doing that we've never done before, and I think we should discuss, is approving by motion these schedules. And the reason that I think that is if we don't agree that the schedules are fluid and can change due to unforeseen circumstances, then later when those things happen, we're told, oh no, we have a schedule and you voted on it. We've got to do it this way. So I'm good with all of this generally, but I don't want to vote for a rock solid schedule given the uncertainty that we have right now.
Mr. Chairman, maybe if I can just respond about the rock solid part of it. In the discussions in the writing group, we did talk about when SEPA public comment comes through, if it's a massive amount that swamps the staff, that we would hear back from them in March. Maybe we're not going to be able to stay with the March and April parts of the schedule. So I think situationally, I do not intend this to be rock solid. But if there are possibilities here where very long delays would occur for things that beget even further delays, I do get concerned about whether or not that warrants a real lengthy delay. And I don't want to imply by this schedule that it opens the door for something that would go on and on and on. And this has gone on for quite a while, that we could have a debate on the merits of such things as the public records request delays and how long that might take. I'm certainly open to that by this motion. And I do expect it to be not rock solid on the hard timeline. But I think we owe people an expectation of when can we get to finality on this. And that's what's intended.
I'll just speak to that a minute. I understand what both Vice Chair Baker and you said, Commissioner McIsaac. I certainly don't want to be part of making it look like we're not intending to get feedback comments from the public. I think that's we get accused of that enough, and I'm somewhat sympathetic to making sure we get it right and we get the proper and needed comments in from stakeholders in the public. So I'm going to go on now to Commissioner Kuntz and then to Commissioner Smith. Commissioner Kuntz, please.
Well, thank you, Chair Carpenter. I was going to echo exactly what Barbara said, that I'm concerned that especially the part about the SEPA review being 20, I think it's 23 days. And I think I would like to move an amendment. And the amendment is that we modify the motion on the floor to strike the last clause. That's it, correct, Nikki? Well, you didn't have to, you could have just left it highlighted. Sorry. But and do I hear a second and then I could speak to it?
I'll second that.
Yeah, okay.
We have a second from Vice Chair Baker.
Yeah, so I think I get to speak to it first. Again, I think that we would be better off just today, Commissioner McIsaac, approving the SEPA, getting it moving along, and that we then instruct the staff to do this in a timely fashion and in a manner that's consistent with law and consideration of the pandemic, and that we expect this to be done in a timely fashion. So I think by parliamentary, if I can point a parliamentary inquiry, I think that after we discuss the amendment, we then vote on the amendment, and then we go back and we can discuss the amended if passed motion, and then we vote on that.
Yes. Well, we have two commissioners with their hands up, and then we can proceed in that direction. Commissioner Smith, I think you were first, and Commissioner Anderson second.
This is actually one of the concerns that I was going to raise, was we literally cannot tie ourselves into an adopted schedule for SEPA. You know, we'd be out of sync if we were to do that. So I do support this. And, you know, again, as the newcomer to the show here, I just want someone to answer again what Barbara, what Commissioner Baker asked earlier, and that is, by this motion, are we making, I'm going to call them on the ground changes this next year? That's my question for maybe Dr. Warheit or point, someone.
Point of order. I think we need to discuss the amendment and then go to the motion.
Oh, okay, but isn't that, that's what I am trying to discuss is.
Well, I don't understand your question. I don't.
Okay. I'll withdraw that question for now, and I'll ask it later.
Okay, I'm going to go to Commissioner Anderson, and then I will call up a rereading of the amended motion. Commissioner Anderson.
Yeah, I'd like to ask Joe Pinesco if he sees that there's an issue with regard to the language on the recommended schedule. It's just a recommended schedule. I don't see it necessarily as such a binding step that we would necessarily have to take, or we would necessarily have to remove it. So perhaps Joe can enlighten us.
Yes, Chair and Commissioner Anderson. There's having a schedule, even if it's expressed as a recommended schedule, but having it done by motion then starts to beg the question that if department staff do begin to deviate from that schedule, do they need an additional motion by the commission to sort of bless that or approve that? So that can be a question. And if the commission says, well, no, we really don't think that, yet you've still got a motion adopting a schedule, depends upon what type of a language you could include in that schedule to say this is just our recommendation. And then the question is, if it's just a recommendation, why is there a need of a motion behind it? But ultimately, it's a policy call for the commission to make on it if it wishes to. You know, be more formalistic of having commission motions on proposed schedules like this versus broader direction to department staff of its expectations on the timing of the department's carrying out the functions that the commission has directed at its policy making level.
I see I have several hands up before we do anything. Commissioner McIsaac and then Commissioner Thorburn.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've probably had a lot of schedules adopted for this particular agenda item that have been modified through time. In fact, I don't know if we have one that has not. And I think any time we adopt a schedule that the commission, the next time they meet, judges what the circumstances are, and it's always the possibility of changing the schedule depending on the situation at hand. So I do think it's important that we try to frame in our mind an intent to get to finality on this. I don't want, like I said, I don't want this to be a hard lock schedule that you can't debate that in the future. I think that it's supposed to be a 2-week SEPA review process. And I think it's common that anytime anybody who's opposed to the action will ask for an extension. And that's a common situation. Maybe they have real good reasons to ask for it, but I think we ought to have a reasonable time for a secret review. And I guess I'll wait to hear from the other folks here, but if people want some softening of this language that I've described, I'd be amenable to an amendment to the amendment to try to soften it. But I do think it's appropriate that we do some general planning here that shows our intent. And the intent would not be to have this process continue on and on and on for months or years beyond where we're at now. There's too much good in this policy for that to just be stopped on that basis.
Thank you, Commissioner McKenzie. Commissioner Thorburn?
Yeah, I'm not going to support the amendment as it's presented. And I appreciate council's input. I think that we improve our process by trying to be transparent about how these issues are moving forward. And I really, I mean, if there's a glitch in a schedule that we put forward and we need more time, I think that's a good thing to bring before the commission to let our stakeholders know what's going on. So in the interest of transparency, I like the idea of putting forward a schedule, and if it needs to change, then we have a discussion about it.
Commissioner Smith, and then Commissioner Anderson, is your hand up? Commissioner Smith.
Yes. Here's why I'm in favor of this. The proposed schedule shows a 2-week SEPA review period. Only threshold determinations that are a determination of non-significance get a 2-week review period. So this could appear as if we have prejudged that the SEPA determination is going to be one of non-significance. And I think that, you know, if we take this schedule off, then obviously we're yielding to the real review process. So that's my concern. 2 weeks is only allowed when there's a determination of non-significance made, you know, with a checklist. Otherwise, an EIS gets 30 days public review.
Thank you, Commissioner Smith. Vice Chair Baker.
I just want to say that, you know, what we are doing in this whole meeting, starting with about 3 days ago, is sort of readjusting and reorienting our commission. My point, and those are things that would be better done in a meeting with us having a retreat or getting our operating procedures down, rather than dragging out every single issue that we've been working on. But that is not to say that this isn't important. The reason that I'm supporting this motion is that I don't particularly believe in having schedules in motions. I think that shows a lack of trust, not of the process, but of each other. I want to say that I agree. I think that Don's presentation on the schedule looks good to me, assuming that we do get a mitigated declaration of insignificance. And if we don't, we're going to have to change it. But those kind of schedules should be discussed between staff and members and interest groups offline. So again, much like the document we were talking about yesterday, which is policy decisions that underlay all of the policy decisions that we make, I think this is extra. It gives us something to argue about, and I think the last half hour kind of proves that.
Okay. We have an amended motion brought forward by Commissioner Kuntz and seconded by, was it Commissioner Smith? I don't recall right now.
It was me.
No, Commissioner Baker, pardon me. Nikki, would you reread Commissioner Kuntz's amended motion, please?
Sure. I move that the commission approves the draft of policy 3619 revisions recommended by the Fish Committee for an assessment of environmental impacts under the State Environmental Policy Act's process, period.
Okay, could we pull down the screen share, please?
Sure.
Chair Carpenter?
Yes, sir.
So just point of clarification. So the motion to amend is to strike the last clause, leaving just the language that Nikki read. But the vote is only on whether to strike the clause, not on whether to approve or reject the underlying language. I just want to be clear that that's
what my understanding. That's my understanding. Does anyone on the commission disagree with that?
I just want to point of clarification, whatever the right thing is. So yes,
go ahead.
Take a vote on striking, then we'll go to the main motion.
That's right.
Thank you.
Okay, we have an amended motion and a second. I'm going to call for the question in a moment. And those of you that put your hand up so Nikki can see it, so we don't have to go back and double up. So all those in favor, Not yet. I'm, okay. All those in favor of the amended motion, put your hands up. There are four hands up. All those opposed to the amended motion, put your hands up. Okay. The amended motion carries. So we will now, okay. Now we got to go back to the original motion, which was made by Don. And I see you have your hand up, Don. Commissioner McKenzie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, let's just go ahead and vote on the main motion, but I think we've been now left with some more business to do after we vote on the main motion.
Okay. We're going to vote on the main motion now. I don't know if we have to put hands up, but we'll see. All those in favor of the main motion, say aye.
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 Oppose? Aye. Oppose, same sign? There were none opposed. Am I correct in what I see on the screen? Is that correct? Okay. The main motion carries. Joe Pinesco.
And again, just to clarify, it is the main motion as was just amended successfully by the 4-3 vote.
That's correct.
Okay.
Commissioner McKenzie.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So what now is not certain is, well, how long is the SEPA review process, the public comment opportunity on this draft going to be? The schedule had 2 weeks in there. We heard something about that's only allowed if it's linked to a non-significant determination, which doesn't happen until after, I'm not sure how that all flowed. But it presupposes, I think, was the argument. So should we have to deal with whether or not we want a two-week or two-year? I shouldn't say it that way, Barbara, I'm sorry. Should we argue now whether it's a two-week public review process or a two-month public review process? Or should we have a motion on the intent that we start this off with some amount and see how it goes.
I will go first to Commissioner Kuntz and then Commissioner Linville. Commissioner Kuntz, please.
Well, again, I apologize for being new, but as the newbie, I don't understand why we can't just talk to the director and make it clear. And I don't know if we have to do this in a public meeting, but just make it clear. That's not me. I don't sing that well. I don't understand, Commissioner McIsaac, why we can't just talk to the director and say, you know, we expect you to direct your staff to get this done in the most timely fashion that's consistent with law and consistent with the pandemic. And, you know, I don't think that we're going to, you know, I think it's going to come out, the public comment period will be somewhere between 2 weeks and 30. Boy, that's singing. At least keep it in key, please. But somewhere between 2 weeks and 4 weeks, Commissioner McIsaac. I don't think we have to be overly concerned or take more time at this meeting. I'm sure, and maybe Director Sisson can comment, and I'm sure that he and the staff can work this out in a way that's legal and timely and a high priority, maybe the high, you know, at the highest level of priority, Director Sisson.
Thank you, Commissioner Kuntz. Commissioner Linville.
Just briefly, I don't think we should be hashing that out right now. SEPA processes are fluid and things do, they just do happen during the SEPA process. And I had another point that just flew out of my head, which is not good. I'm going to leave it at that since my point flew out of my head. I apologize.
Commissioner McKenzie, can you stand up? Commissioner McKenzie.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And of course, I think what we're trying to do is get out of the commission micromanaging this kind of thing. But let me play this out. So there's a review draft that's been approved for the staff to assess the environmental impacts. The month of February, they're going to work on that. Sometime toward the end of February, there are challenges to be done with that. If it comes out as a non-significant impact, then a two-week public review period would seem reasonable. If it comes out that no, it's a, deserves a one-year EIS, then maybe a two-week comment period's not. So, you know, if that's enough direction to our director, Kelly Susiwind, maybe that's fine. But I guess I would just like to be sure that that we don't get into a situation where the commission's intent to not move forward in an expeditious manner gets confusing, and all of a sudden we're into more delays.
Well, I think the director is online now and has a comment pending.
That works for us. I think we actually skipped over the first step, which is the one to get the SEPA document review ready through the month of February. That's critical. And we will do that. We'll commit to doing that. And at that point, direct us, or I'm taking this direction as I'll interpret the direction I've received thus far to be proceed through SEPA. Once we have that done, get it done in February, and then proceed through SEPA as expediently as possible, depending on the outcome.
Thank you, Director. Molly, did Commissioner Linville, did you have another comment?
I just remembered my my one before.
Go my ahead, then I have one.
I had a moment there. I'm kind of cognizant of the fact that North of Falcon falls in that, and that, you know, always seems to, I think that's a something just to keep in mind on time.
Okay. Well, as far as I'm concerned, that brings this issue to closure. Kelly has got the ball. Ron, you might get a handoff. And if there's no other comments, we'll bring this issue to closure. It was well vetted, I think, and we'll go from there. Okay, does anyone have any interest in taking 5 minutes or no minutes and just keep going? What's your pleasure?
Another cup of coffee.
Ten. How about, let's see, it's 11:45. Let's come back at noon. Does that work? Ron's got to get a sandwich, so here we go.